I'm Christopher Lighton. This is Open Source at the Watson Institute at Brown University, with three objectives in this conversation about the Iraq War. First, call it a year-end review, the surge year of the American war, which John McCain says with a straight face, we are finally winning. But it's also a five-year review of a war that began in March 2003 and in which President Bush declared mission accomplished almost immediately. And because our guest is the Middle East historian Juan Cole, we're also looking for a two-century review of Western military adventures in the region. Juan Cole teaches history at the University of Michigan by day. By night, he compiles a daily briefing on the war from the best reporting and intelligence available in English and Arabic, and then he publishes it in his blog every day, Informed Comment. Juan, I've said this before, I call you one of the great gifts that the web has given us, and consistently you're my best source of what's to be counted or discounted in the war story. And all of this time, Juan Cole has been also writing a history of Napoleon's invasion and occupation of Egypt, starting in 1798, in the aftermath of the French Revolution, on the way to becoming Emperor of France and the Lord of all Europe. How did it happen, Juan Cole, that you undertook this Napoleon history 15 years ago, when Bush, Cheney, and their designs on Iraq hadn't appeared anywhere?
Well, in modern Middle Eastern history, there has been a tendency among many authors to date, you know, the modern period from General Bonaparte's invasion of Egypt. And so, it had often been said, you know, Bonaparte brought a printing press with him. So that was the beginning of the printing revolution in the Middle East, that he reorganized Egypt along modern lines, and this was the beginning of social reform, and to really invest that moment of the French advent in the Middle East with all of the patina of an embryonic modernity, and it is. And if you are in the field, you know it is a very famous incident, and in some ways has been claimed by many as a starting point. Even when I was a graduate student, one of my professors back in the 70s urged me to rethink the entire thing, and said that in his view the range of material on the matter hadn't been fully used. And the bicentenary was approaching in the 1990s. 1998 was the 200-year anniversary. And that approach of the bicentenary reminded me of my old professor's advice. And so I started looking into it. And in the meantime, a wonderful bibliography had been published in France of the eyewitness accounts that survived. And there were, 300, 400 of them, and clearly had not the full range of those had not been used by other historians.
They're fascinating. I mean, they are the sort of soldier bloggers of their time. There's a remarkable diversity in their views. Of course, France was imbued with new notions of liberty, its role, fraternity, the whole thing. And you get that range of opinions, including a lot of dissent among the French officers and people who kept journals or wrote letters. And still, that's just the beginning of the sort of parallelisms of this double hindsight on Napoleon and on, should we say, Bush, Cheney in Iraq. Where do you begin in listing the parallels or non-parallels?
Well, the parallels are really quite remarkable. The first parallel is that it is a war of choice, and that indeed the full reasoning behind it has never been entirely clear. And historians still argue as to why the French should have invaded Egypt, what in the world was on their minds. And it's also not clear why the United States went into Iraq. Beyond that, of course, there is the issue of how a Western Christian society governs a Arab Muslim one, the problems of gaining legitimacy, which I think are insurmountable, the deployment of modern democratic ideas as a as an ideological cover for the conquest. And so Bonaparte talked about bringing liberty to Egypt, liberating the Egyptians from the yoke of their tyrannical Ottoman government, and spreading the ideals of the rights of man amongst them. And French officers actually wrote in their memoirs that they expected the Egyptians to be grateful for being so liberated.
Mm.
So this messianic republicanism, with a small r, mm-hmm. of bringing those revolutionary ideals to other peoples, is there. But of course, this had been done in Europe as well. By the time the French set out for Egypt, Holland, for instance, had been made an appendage of France and
Belgium,
Switzerland.
No?
As well, and well, I think Belgium was directly incorporated, but Holland was constituted as Batavia, which was a sister republic, essentially, or daughter republic, let us say. And daughter republics had been set up in what is now Italy as well. So there was this idea of the French revolutionary state as a hub, which could then have satellites. And in those satellites, there would be elections and relative freedom of the press and so forth. But in the background, the French military would lurk. And so the new republics would be subordinate to France. So it was an odd kind of republican empire. And it was intended that Egypt be added to those satellites.
Napoleon actually spoke of a, quote, French Republic of Egypt, did he not?
Yes, he did, and one of the memoirists talked about all the countries of France. So France becomes this transcendent ideal into which other countries can be incorporated.
Fascinating. And then on the dark side, there is this horrendous trail of blood and brutality, summary executions, massacres, mass slaughter of unarmed prisoners, this kind of thing. Going on at the same time. I mean, I don't want to say it makes Abu Ghraib look like a picnic, but certainly there was a vicious underside of this high-mindedness runs through the whole invasion.
Absolutely. The invasion and conquest of Egypt was an extremely brutal affair. The brutality of it has, I think, been downplayed by by generations of French historians who tend to focus on the civilizational aspects of the invasion. In fact, they don't even call it an invasion. In French, they call it an expedition, as though it's an exploratory expedition or something. But in fact, it was an invasion and a conquest, and the peasantry turned out to be armed and organized, as were the Bedouin tribes. And they weren't at all happy to see the French by most accounts. And they organized to fight them. They harassed the French soldiers. If you were marching in a line and you fell a little bit behind, the Bedouin would capture you. They would hold you for ransom. They might torture you. So the French lost a lot of men to the Bedouin harassment. The peasants rebelled when the French came in to collect taxes. Sometimes they would just kill the French tax collectors. They turned out to be armed. About 15% of the Egyptian peasants had muskets and knew how to deploy them. So the French faced these constant tribal and peasant rebellions, which they then put down with some brutality, and they would burn villages, they would behead people, and hang the heads on the road as a warning to others.
You quote Napoleon himself, in translation, of course, saying, in a letter to another general, "Every day I cut off 5 or 6 heads in the streets of Cairo. We had to manage them up to the present in such a way as to erase that reputation for terror that preceded us." Had to raise it a notch. Do we believe these things happened and that he wrote that stuff?
Well, he certainly wrote that letter. Some historians have wondered whether he wasn't boasting, but I can't see why he would boast to another general in Egypt. He was talking about his policy, which was a policy of instilling terror in the population. He felt that when they first came in, they had to convince people that they were not marauders, so as to try to get them on their side. But then once they were established, in order to instill discipline in the population, it was necessary to engage in a certain amount of state terror. And he was recommending the policy to this other general. And there are many, many accounts in the memoirs of summary justice and of making object lessons of people. And so I think it's entirely plausible that Bonaparte was cutting off a few heads a day.
Juan Cole, the other grand parallels here between Napoleon in Egypt and Bush-Cheney in Iraq include the fiasco that developed. In Napoleon's case, they'd forgot to bring canteens in a stifling hot part of the world. They ran out of money. They didn't dig into the local economy as they had planned to. I mean, it went bad very fast, and Napoleon couldn't get out of there fast enough, in a sense, himself. At the same time, and not unlike our own situation, there was a cover story and a rallying of public opinion back home, or at least a disguising of what was actually going on that went on for years. And I don't think Napoleon ever apologized or confessed that it had come to a horrible reverse. Make what you will of that pattern.
Well, Bonaparte, in a way, invented modern democratic propaganda. He managed to convince the French newspapers back home that he was engaged in a glorious set of conquests. And indeed, when the French were trapped in Egypt and the British sank the French fleet, even after that, when the Ottomans attempted to land in summer of 1799 and the French beat them off and didn't allow the Ottoman troops onto Egyptian soil again, the French newspapers went wild with this news that the French had managed to avoid being invaded, but they depicted it as this great military victory. Snatching any kind of victory from the jaws of defeat was played up. There was this hunger for good news, conviction that, well, things might turn around, things are not going so badly. And Bonaparte parlayed this kind of propaganda into a reputation back in France as a conqueror of the Orient. And it was one of the bases on which he was able to make a coup and come to power as first consul. So not only did the Egyptian fiasco not harm him politically, but he actually made it an asset.
The other striking thing is, and this is out of your book, that it was not the end of the adventure for France. He may have been ahead of his time in seeing the vulnerability of the Ottoman Empire to European attack. And, of course, the French went on, maybe under the banner of that Egyptian campaign, to North Africa and a century in Algeria, not to mention Southeast Asia. So it was an odd start, but the colonial and imperial venture was just beginning.
Yes, Bonaparte failed in what he attempted to do in Egypt, but in a way he failed because he was an early adopter. He saw potentials that others then later realized. Although the Egyptians rebelled constantly, and the French weren't able to stay in Egypt in part because of British naval superiority and British opposition to the project. Later on, in 1830, the French took Algeria, and although they faced massive rebellions, they managed to stay and with great brutality. And then, as you say, went on to take Tunisia and ultimately Syria and so forth. And Bonaparte was convinced that the Ottoman Empire was in rapid decline, that the Europeans would pick up the pieces, and so Russia and Britain might well position themselves to gain territory in the Middle East. And that if that was the case, then France should position itself to be the heir of the Ottoman Empire and to pick up those pieces. So he was right about the dynamics. He was off by about a century.
And still some very aggressively tough-minded people, neocons perhaps, would say this was not a failure. on Napoleon's part, and it was rather an acceptable example of the sort of hits you have to take on the way to being the superpower. I mean,
right. Well, actually, some neoconservatives have actually responded to my book in that vein.
Really?
Yes. Martin Kramer said something to that effect at his weblog. They're not completely wrong, but what I would say about it is this, that Bonaparte failed in part because of intra-European rivalries. And so the British and Russian alliance with the Ottomans was deadly to what he was trying to do. But he failed also because in 1798, Western European military and technological and organizational superiority over the Ottoman Empire just was not that great. I mean, there was some superiority, but it wasn't overwhelming. And so it was too soon. By 1830, French arms and military operations were much in advance of what they had been 30 years before. And so they were able to take Algeria but hold it. I would say that, you know, how colonialism is received depends on the relative superiority of the colonizer over the colonized, with regard, especially to military technology, but also to some organizational affairs, and including, you know, how wide ranging one's economy is and vigorous the economy is, and so forth. So. I would say that Bonaparte failed because he tried it too early, that the Bush-Cheney attempt in Iraq failed because they tried it too late.
Hmm.
By the mid-20th century, the peoples of the Third World, or the Global South, had mobilized socially. They were becoming more and more urbanized, more literate. They were joining political parties. Nowadays, they have the internet. So they're connected and organized in a way they had not been before. You have asymmetrical weaponry. Roadside bombs are an example. Guerrilla tactics. So that, you know, it's not an accident that the age of empire ended after World War II over the succeeding decades, that Britain lost India, which it had had for 200 years, and so forth. And I think that kind of direct colonialism, where the U.S. goes in and rules another country, as it did in the Philippines, is now impossible to sustain, just because local populations are far too mobilized, have too many resources, and will fight back against that. People have been organized by nation states, and you know, the United States can be enormously influential over another country, but it can't rule another country without facing a massive insurgency. I see Bonaparte's Egypt and the Bush-Cheney misadventure in Iraq as bookends of the colonial period, one precocious and the other far too late.
Maybe that's the cue to talk about 5 years of this Iraq war in recent perspective now. But the American design in hindsight is still obscure in certain ways, but it's getting clearer. And I'd also like you to talk, maybe against the background of Egypt's insurgency against Napoleon, about what we're only beginning to understand about the force of the resistance and the insurgency in Iraq. What's the five-year score from one call on this adventure in Baghdad and surrounding towns?
Well, it wasn't a cakewalk. I think the full destructive character of this war has been hidden from the American people by the way it's been reported and by U.S. government spokespersons. We have a war which has displaced externally, has chased Iraqis out of Iraq in the hundreds of thousands and perhaps millions. There are some 2 million Iraqis in Jordan and Syria, living in squalor, many of them having lost everything. Many of their children are facing malnutrition. The children are not being schooled. and they're living hand to mouth and don't know where their next meal is coming from. That's 2 million people. That's a lot of people to be made refugees. It's more than Darfur. You know, there's a. I'm not playing down the tragedy of Darfur. I'm just saying Iraq is a greater tragedy. And 2 million Iraqis are estimated to have been displaced inside the country. And again, with terrible social consequences. And those 4 million displaced Iraqis are not even on the horizon of most Americans. The idea that the United Nations aid for them is running out and that somebody is going to have to step up to make sure that those children don't starve to death, that's not even an agenda item in the U.S. Congress. But we are responsible in some large part for what has happened to those people, for this massive displacement of populations. And I think that we have a real responsibility. You know, if we're going to pass a $100 billion supplemental for the Iraq War, that the Congress should divert at least $1 billion of it to taking care of these Iraqi refugees that we have created. And beyond the massive displacement of persons, there's a devastated economy. There's very high unemployment. About a third of the children are missing meals. There's a lack of potable water. There's high rates of infant mortality, and the little children get diarrhea because of bad water. There have been cholera outbreaks. The public health situation is horrible. And then, of course, the loss of life has been tremendous. I think the projections of the Lancet study done by public health professionals with the same methods that are used in places like Darfur are solid, and they indicate that a year ago already some 600,000 excess deaths had occurred in Iraq because of the war. These are not all owing to bombings or sniping, but a large number of them are. Other excess deaths come from just the general insecurity, from tribal feuding, from criminality, taking children for ransom and killing them when they don't get the ransom, and so forth. So the human toll of this war for Iraqis has been enormous. I mean, it's epochal. And it is something that you couldn't tell by opening an American newspaper that we have done this to those people. And of course, some of what has happened is owing to resistance to the U.S. Presence. And the apologists for the war would say, "Well, that's not our fault if people resisted and they had to be fought and so forth. But if we hadn't invaded, then they wouldn't have resisted." So it all comes from our decision to fight an elective war in Iraq. And then there's a big Sunni-Shiite battle for Baghdad, the outcome of which is apparently that the Shiites have taken Baghdad. Some 75% of the population of Baghdad is now Shiite. It was probably 50-50 when Bush took Baghdad in 2003. And the Sunni-Arab population is fit to be tied. They certainly are not going to take this lying down, and there's going to be a subsequent battle for Baghdad again, as soon as the U.S. Draws down some troops and the Sunnis and the Shiites can get a bead on one another.
Juan Cole, stand by just for a moment. Catch your breath. We're talking with Juan Cole, professor of history at the University of Michigan. His new book is called Napoleon's Egypt, Invading the Middle East. He calls it a bookend invasion, 200 years roughly before the Americans landed in Iraq. You just made a very interesting point, though, about the Sunni-Shia divisions. And it's in your blog and your even the book, which is to say that we say not only it's their fault for the instability of their own country, and we also say the Sunni-Shia division is not our business exactly, but it seems to me you're asking us to see that division as a way, almost a device by which a society fends off domination from outside. It makes itself ungovernable. It wastes its own treasure to make itself, in another way, less vulnerable. That's a perspective we would never read in the American press, but is it plausible to you?
It's certainly the case that the Sunni Arab guerrilla movement has targeted Shiites over and over and over again in an attempt to provoke sectarian feuding, and in the hopes that that feuding would be so widespread and so tumultuous for society that it would make Iraq ungovernable and the Americans would be forced out by it. Yes.
That's a kind of triple think, and it undermines one of the sort of mental devices by which we get ourselves off the hook for their so-called religious, you know, fanaticism. But I wonder who would have thought that up as a strategy, or is it simply something that a society under terrible pressure does?
Well, I think the initial idea of doing it probably emanated both from the Ba'ath Party, which is still a factor to reckon with in the north of the country, and from the Salafi jihadis, the people that the U.S. is pleased to call al-Qaeda, the Sunni fundamentalist radicals. One knows that Iraq is still a society where honor and vendettas and feuding take place and are important to people for their sense of self-worth, and that if you can get them to engage in a lot of feuds, that it roils things and makes it difficult for the government to become strong and established. So it's a guerrilla strategy, I think lots of insurgencies have used tactics like that. I think it's part of what was going on in Cambodia under Pol Pot. It is a horrible strategy, of course, but it had in 2006 came, I think, and early 2007 came to an apogee of sorts, in which it was having a great deal of success in the terms under which it was being pursued, of making Iraq ungovernable and of beginning to force the United States out.
It sounds a little bit like medical, you know, bleeding or leeching to take someone infection out, even at a cost to the vitality of the body, or some sort of natural, you know, analogy like that.
The thing to keep in mind is that Sunni Shiite divisions and riots and battles are not characteristic of 20th century Iraq. If you go back to the newspapers of the 1940s, 50s, 60s, you never see anything in them about Sunni Shiite violence. So there is a tendency in the U.S. press to talk about age-old hatreds and so forth, and there's no evidence for the hatreds being age-old. This is a tactic.
Back to the connection with your book on Napoleon, would that we had 200 years perspective on the United States and Iraq. If we did, what kind of hindsight wisdom are we getting about the American project there in general? In Napoleon's case, as you say, it was thoroughly ambiguous. The sailors on the ships didn't know where they were going when they left Toulon in 1798. They thought they might be going on a strange Mediterranean tack to England. They thought they might be going to disrupt England's rule over India. It turned out, for Napoleon's rather personal reasons, to be Egypt. So a lot of dust had to settle before the nature of that adventure came clear. 5 years after the war in Iraq began, what do we really know about, what are we going to think in the future about what this thing was all about?
Well, I think there's a parallel in the sense that many of the U.S. troops that were sent to Iraq believed that they were fighting the people who did 9/11, and they had pictures of the two towers on their backpacks and so forth. So they weren't in any doubt that they were going to Iraq, but the Iraq that they were going to was imaginary because Iraq had never had anything to do with al-Qaeda or 9/11. How will this be seen in the future, or what do we think was the real reason for it? I think these things are overdetermined. I think trying to find one reason for which Bush went to war with Iraq is probably futile. I think any administration is made up of constituencies, and those constituencies can all, you know, be satisfied sometimes with a single venture. So, of course, Stephen Walt and John Mearsheimer have argued that the Iraq War was pursued in very large part by people who were committed to the survival of and welfare of Israel in the administration. I think that certainly was a consideration. I don't think it was the only consideration. I believe personally that the Cheney camp, Cheney had been CEO of Halliburton, that the Cheney camp did have its eye on creating a favorable international security environment for the provisioning to the U.S. of oil and gas in the next 20 to 25 years at a time when there's increasing pressure on petroleum prices and supplies because of the competition coming from rising Asian giants like China and India, and particularly China. And I think in the same way that Bonaparte's taking of Egypt was in some ways an indirect blow against British rivalry with France, so the taking of Iraq was an indirect blow against the future threat of China and the possibility that Persian Gulf petroleum would somehow be monopolized by China, because you have these hostile regimes in the region, which are big oil producers like Iraq and Iran, that were likely to be drawn into Beijing's orbit. So I don't think the petroleum issue can be sidelined, and I think that you know, there were advantages to Bush in being a war president. I think electoral reasons came into it. When you have a war, obviously you're throwing a lot of money from the government at certain businesses, businesses which in turn are likely to support your reelection campaign. And I think that the prospect of conquering Iraq also appealed to the evangelical community at the time, because they were hoping to turn Iraq into a mission field. They were hoping that the Shiites might be receptive to the Southern Baptist persuasion, and that then they could use Iraq as a platform to evangelize the rest of the Middle East. So, I think each part of the administration had its own reasons for which this war was appealing, and I think it was overdetermined. There were lots of reasons there, and finding just one is difficult. And that's why often it's said that we can't understand why they did it at all. It's because they did it for so many different reasons.
Roman numeral three. After Roman numeral one, Napoleon II, the five-year view, Roman numeral three is after the surge, after this relative moments, at least, of calm in Baghdad. What's the story of this war in 2007, Juan Cole?
Well, 2007 was a year which began horrifically. You were having 2,000 and 3,000 civilians killed a month. There were 70 bodies in the morning in Baghdad. There was a severe ethnic cleansing. I think the big story from the point of view of the mainstream press in the United States will be the success of the surge, the relative tamping down of violence by the extra 30,000 troops that were put in, the troop escalation. I think, however, that underneath that story is possibly a more important story that I adverted to before, that Baghdad has gone from being 50% Sunni and 50% Shiite to being 75% Shiite. And some of that shift has occurred this year. The U.S. military, at least, said in January of 2007 that Baghdad was 65% Shiite. And then it came out this summer and said that Baghdad was 75% Shiite. I suspect that the American troop escalation allowed the U.S. to go into Sunni neighborhoods, clear out guerrillas, confiscate arms, that essentially they disarmed these Sunni Arab neighborhoods in Baghdad, and that at night the Mahdi army and the Badr Corps, the Shiite paramilitaries, took advantage of the disarming of the Sunni Arabs to engage in death squad activity, to threaten people and to ethnically cleanse them from mixed neighborhoods, and to take over some neighborhoods. So the map of Iraq, if you painted the Sunnis blue and the Shiites red, the map of Iraq has the map of Baghdad has gone red, and this is an epochal shift. The Sunni Arab world is appalled, and certainly will not accept this as a permanent outcome. So that's one of the big things that happened in 2007. The boiling over of the Kurdistan issue, where in the north the Kurdish ethnic group has constituted itself as a state within a state. It is making a play to incorporate more of Iraq into itself with the oil province of Kirkuk, which is ethnically mixed, and Arabs and Turkmen up there don't want to be under Kurdish rule. The fighting between Kurds and America's ally, Turkey, is a big story. So although it certainly is part of the mix that the U.S. troop escalation has reduced violence, it hasn't eliminated violence. There's still a lot of violence. Baghdad is a violent city, and it's dangerous. I think there are other sort of social history movements going on with regard to the Sunni-Shiite battle for Baghdad and the Kurdish battle for dominance in the north that are probably more important in the long run, and also which dangerous with regard to future security.
Juan Cole, all this has a strange dampening effect on the 08 presidential campaign in our country. Immigration has almost overwhelmed Iraq as a subject, a talking point in these debates. Is this because the candidates are being tactful with the country and the Bush administration about what everybody seems to know now is a blunder, or is it they simply don't know or don't want to grapple with the lessons of kind of neo-colonial, neo-imperialism?
Well, you know, the first thing to say is that Iraq is very important to the American people, and the most recent polling I've seen suggests that among respondents, 29% list the Iraq war as their number one concern in the presidential election. That's down from 34% in September, but it's still by far the most important issue, that is to say, more people listed as number one than any other issue by far. So immigration, I think, is like 17% or something is of people listed as number one. So it's much less important. I think that that it's artificial, that Iraq has kind of being taken off the agenda for the election. I think the problem is that it's very difficult to campaign on Iraq, because the American people clearly have decided that the war was a mistake, and they clearly want out over time, but they're deeply divided over a timetable for getting out. They want a timetable, by the way. Almost everybody says that they want a timetable for withdrawal. So there's no sentiment among the American people for an open-ended commitment to Iraq. But I think about certainly a plurality of Americans, 45-48%, are afraid that if you did the Richardson plan, you know, if you just pulled out altogether by March of 08, that the Persian Gulf would go to hell in a handbasket, and then U.S. energy supplies would be endangered, and you know, people would end up paying $10 a gallon for their gasoline and so forth. So I think there is caution in the public about speed of withdrawal. But I think that in some ways this issue has been so settled that that the American public wants out of Iraq on some kind of a gradual timetable, that it's difficult to campaign on it just because there's such a big consensus about that.
It's settled, I agree, in a certain way, but it hasn't the judgment hasn't been defined. To me, the sort of the dog that hasn't barked is this silence of what I would call the anti-imperialist feeling that was very articulate, very famous 100 years ago in the words of Mark Twain and Andrew Carnegie and William James and many others who said very clearly that the McKinley Teddy Roosevelt annexation of the Philippines was a disgrace and a mistake and ought not to be repeated. It didn't necessarily become the dominant view, but it was out there. And I keep waiting, for some reason or other, to hear that articulated after the Iraq fiasco.
Well, I think there's an intervening variable of September 11th, and I think the September 11th effect is still with us in a sense that, you know, the Philippines didn't attack us, although our yellow press in the McKinley era did try to convince
Remember
us
the Maine,
Spanish
indeed.
Empire had.
Yeah.
Yes. So, nevertheless, September 11th was a truly extraordinary event in American history to have, first of all, the American mainland has very seldom been attacked by a foreign nation, and to have such a dramatic attack on U.S. soil with such large loss of life was shocking to the American public, and I think allowed the Bush administration to pursue projects like the Iraq War. Mm. And I think there's a lingering effect of fear that the U.S. Ought not to do things that make itself vulnerable because it has been shown to be vulnerable. And so I think that has instilled a certain caution in the debate. But the 9/11 effect is receding. If there's not another big attack, then it seems to me over time that the American people are not tolerant of imperial adventures, and the likelihood that they're going to go on being willing to see their congressional representatives voting for $100 billion supplementals at a time when, you know, there are a lot of schools in the United States that need to be painted. I think the ride the Bush administration has had on this is over with. And the opinion polling is very clear on this.
Juan Cole, you're interesting and maybe even hopeful as the holidays have come in 2007. I can't say often enough how I treasure your blog. I call you the Thucydides of the war in Iraq, thanks partly to the internet, but always instructive and independent and worth reading. Thank you so much for joining us on Open Source again. We'd love to do it again in 2008.
Thanks so much, Chris. I'd love to come on anytime.